This is an ABC podcast.
Beth Macy lives in the United States in an Appalachian town called Roanoke, Virginia. Some years ago, as a journalist for a local newspaper, Beth became aware of a silent epidemic within the area, an outbreak of opioid addiction among students and farmers and workers and unemployed people. This led Beth to investigate the origins of this new drug epidemic, which had crept up on America almost by stealth. Beth Macy followed the chain of circumstances that she found had led so many local people from painkillers to heroin, and from there to even stronger drugs like fentanyl. Beth spoke to grief-stricken parents who found it impossible to imagine their kids shooting up, right up until the moment they found needles hidden in their bedrooms among the books and the soccer trophies. Her research led her to a pharmaceutical company that had become massively enriched by the introduction of a painkiller called OxyContin, which was aggressively and misleadingly marketed as a safe opioid with safeguards against addiction. Beth Macy's book is called Dope Sick, and she's here with the Sydney Writers' Festival. Hello, Beth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me how you met Jesse Bolstridge's mother, this young man who had died, and you attended his gravesite with his mother. Tell me about how you met her.
Sure. I was actually trying to track down at the time what was then the largest heroin ring in Virginia. And according to the lawyers and the prosecutors who were and the ATF agents that were investigating this case, this dealer had landed in this small, not distressed community, kind of a farm town called Woodstock, Virginia, and had set about turning the handful of known heroin users into hundreds almost overnight. But of course, it was a much more complicated story than that. I asked them to tell me one of the persons who had died as a result of Ronnie Jones's actions, and that led me to the story of Jesse Bolstridge. And when I called his mom up to ask if I could meet her, she said, how about we meet at Jesse's gravesite? And the important thing to know about his gravesite, you know, he was only 19 years old when he died. He had been a football star and a really charismatic kid, the kind of player that could get on the field and put his arms up and everybody would cheer. He would walk around his neighborhood and the cats would follow him as he walked. And he was just this bright kid. And she had him buried at the edge of the cemetery, which was right next to the high school football field. And his headstone was about 4 feet high and had large 55, which was had been his football number. And she asked me to meet her there so I could see her tribute to him, but also so I could help her figure out why it was her only son, who never missed a day of work. He was doing construction work at the time of his death. How he became overdosed and died on someone else's bathroom floor with a needle in his arm. And as so many parents said, I thought it was just pills, in quotes. I had no idea. Will you help me figure out what happened? And that's when I started sort of peeling the layers in the onion and seeing that it was so much more than just the story of Ronnie Jones.
So who is Ronnie Jones, the dealer in question here?
Ronnie Jones was, at the time, a twice convicted drug felon. He was serving out the last of a prison sentence by working in a chicken processing plant near Woodstock, where Jesse was from. And, you know, I ended up interviewing him. I went to prison. He's currently serving a 23-year sentence. But when I went to interview him and heard sort of how he got the idea to do this, and, you know, he said he was in the break room and he noticed that a lot of people were already addicted to pills. And somebody said to him, you know, the heroin is much cheaper to get and easier to get, but people have to drive to Baltimore, which is about an hour or more, a little bit more than that, away from Woodstock. And if you bring it in bulk, you'll be able to make a lot more money. And
perhaps it's a naive question, but why did he want to leave the chicken processing plant behind in order to become a heroin dealer?
Well, when he finished his sentence, no one would hire him because in the U.S., if you have a felony, it's really, really hard to get a job. So he went back to what he knew, which was drug dealing. Prior to that, he had sold crack and marijuana. And then he remembered somebody in the break room saying, you know, heroin is the way to go because hundreds of thousands of people addicted these pills in the U.S. now. So he got a source in Harlem and he started bringing it in bulk.
And how was it ferried in? How did he actually start bringing it back to where he lived?
He would send addicted young women mainly up on the Chinatown bus. What they were doing at this particular drug house is they were packaging, or they called it re-rocking, the big chunks of heroin into these hockey puck shaped like discs that fit perfectly inside of a Pringles can.
Oh, man.
The young woman would just look like they were carrying back snacks in a Walmart plastic bag. According to the prosecutor, when he would leave town, hundreds of people in the little town were getting dope sick because they had run out of their supply.
How big did this organization he set up get?
Well, at the end, they put 84 people in prison on drug.
84 people. This is huge, in other words.
Yeah, and when I first saw the chart, I was interviewing a prosecutor whom I had interviewed a few years earlier for this newspaper series I was doing. And I was saying, tell me how it's changed since I was last back 4 years earlier writing about heroin when it first landed in Roanoke, the city where I've been a reporter for 3 decades. And he said, well, let me show you this chart of this case I just put away. And it was the Ronnie Jones case. And it was a pyramid with Jones at the top. And at the bottom were low-level dealers. Some of the names were already crossed out because they had overdosed and died. And I knew my goal was eventually to get to Jones, but I started interviewing people, you know, on the bottom rungs of the pyramid, many of whom were in jail. I started corresponding with people in prison, and many of them were addicted. They were dealing in order to use.
So it was a bit like a pyramid scheme then, in a way?
In some ways, yeah.
Right, so people were encouraging friends to deal and use at this, once they had become dealers and users themselves?
That's right, because once somebody gets addicted, they have to have it in order not to be dope sick. I mean, that's the thing. People forget, like, they get these cravings and they almost can't overcome them. And it's one hell of a business model when you think about it. If you could passing out these pills or whatnot at a party, and then suddenly you have more people you can deal to, it's easier for you if you're already addicted.
Who typically were these dealers? Were they the kind of typical, quote unquote, low life drug dealers that, you know, you see in movies, or was it different from that?
No, it's different from that. It was people like one of the guys that helped me that was sort of midway up the rung. He's now in prison in North Carolina, about to get out, actually. But he had been a tree trimmer, and he was on probation for a former charge. He was about to go to jail for that former charge, and he wanted to get some money to put on his books, on his jail account books, and also to help his daughter. And so he started dealing in order to supply his own habit, but also to save money for this jail sentence that he had awaiting him. And that's how he got back into dealing. But most people who are truly addicted deal in order to use themselves. They call it middle manning.
Middle manning. So how did Jesse Bostrich, this nice football star, come to be using heroin in such serious quantities?
Yeah. Well, his mother goes all the way back to when he was little. He was kind of one of these hyperactive kids, would never take a nap. And, you know, eventually he would just crash on the floor with toys in each hand. And when he got to kindergarten, the teacher said, he is really riled up. We need to do something about this. So, you know, I recommend you take him to a doctor. I think he has ADHD. And she resisted at first. And so a couple years later, she was still hearing complaints from the teachers, and they put him on Ritalin, and the complaints stopped. And when he became a teenager and started, you know, going to parties and drinking and whatnot, he was also having a lot of sports injuries, right? Snowboarding, football injuries, things of that nature. And he was getting pills prescribed to him, like roxycodone, which is another form of oxycodone, like OxyContin. And he became addicted fairly quickly because of the prescribed medications. And he realized in sort of the teen party world that pills were worth a lot. The Ritalin was worth a lot. And a lot of teenagers, I mean, I have a son in college, and he says, finals week, mom, the Ritalin, the Adderall is off the hook. Everybody's doing it to stay awake all night studying. A lot of teenagers also take Ritalin and Adderall and other ADHD medications so they can stay up all night drinking. And so he started trading his Ritalin for pills, for opioid pills that kids were getting either prescribed to them or left over in medicine cabinets. Because you go back to the beginning, for 100 years, we knew in America that opioids were addictive, because we'd had a huge morphine wave after the Civil War. And so we clamped down. We didn't prescribe opioids until the mid-1990s again. When we forgot the lesson that we knew that they should only be used in cases of severe pain, end-of-life, cancer, and we started prescribing. And that meant that America's communal medicine cabinet was stuffed with these leftover pills, because surgeons still do it. They prescribe more opioids than you need after surgery.
I had a very nasty accident where I had to have skin grafts. It ran about 2011. And afterwards, to treat the pain, I was given OxyContin and other drugs like Endone afterwards, and that seemed to do the trick. But when I got home, I was given some more, but my wife insisted I get off it straight away. And I had like flu-like symptoms for 2 days afterwards, which really surprised me. I suppose it's understandable that one would feel these withdrawal symptoms, but I was quite shocked that it had had that effect on me. You're saying that up until the mid-1990s, that a prescription of opioids for pain was rare, or it was only used for extreme cases of pain, end-of-life pain, cancer pain, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. This was not so much a new thing, but a thing that had been introduced after a long break where physicians had been unwilling to prescribe opioids. What changed in the mid-90s?
Well, in the mid-90s, much of it was pharmaceutical company funded. There was this effort to start treating pain as a fifth vital sign. And there was this mistaken notion, false notion, in my opinion, that pain was being widely overtreated. So
undertreated, you mean?
Or, yes, widely undertreated. Sorry about that. And so Purdue releases this drug called OxyContin in 1996, and it hires an army of sales reps to go around all over the country saying that we know opioids have been addictive for a long time, but we have this new drug, and it has this 12-hour time release mechanism. And look here on our insert. The FDA allows us to say that because of this 12-hour mechanism, which is supposed to allow the drug to bleed out over 12 hours, that it's safer. It's believed to reduce the liability of addiction and abuse. And the FDA had never allowed a claim like that, but it did in this case. So when the reps went all over America, they bought prescribing data information. So they knew which doctors in which communities were already prescribing competing opioids, which were immediate released. Those tended to be areas that had high instances of workplace injuries.
Working class communities, right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So like coal mining, manufacturing places.
Logging, fishing, right. In Maine, places like that. Appalachia, really right. Hard. And so the reps really focused in on those regions. And they went to those doctors and they said, look, this drug is safer than our competing immediate released opioids. The FDA allows us to say it. And they paid 5,000 doctors, nurses, and pharmacists to become paid speakers for the company, promoting the notion that OxyContin was only addictive in, quote, less than 1% of all cases.
And what was this time release mechanism that they claimed would allow the medication to sort of slowly bleed out rather than to, you know, hit the patient in one big hit?
It was actually the coating of the pill. It was something they developed in their labs. Users quickly figured out an end run, and really they didn't have to look far because in the insert there was language that said, please don't crush this, you know, it could lead to death and et cetera. It was kind of like a guide on how to misuse OxyContin. But what users quickly figured out was that if they put the tablet in their mouth, the coating would melt and then they could crush it and snort it and or liquefy it and inject it for an immediate end run around the 12-hour mechanism.
Right, so these are like M&Ms, are they? They've got sort of a, not that M&Ms or anything like this, but to get the chocolate coating, you just got to get around the sugary outside of these.
I wish I would have thought of that. That's a great metaphor. So one of the first cops that noticed OxyContin was being sold on the streets, he noticed that people were walking around with green and orange stains on their shirt sleeves, and that was from the 40 and 80 milligram version of the pill. So one was green and one was orange.
Right, so they're putting it in their mouths, sucking on the time-release shell, rubbing it on the shirt? Is that what they were doing?
Yeah, right. To get it down to pure oxycodone that then they could then crush. And the other thing they could do was they could just simply chew it, which it said on the insert, don't do.
The company that released OxyContin, Purdue Pharmaceutical, who are they? Tell me a bit more about them.
So it's a privately held company. It's not traded on the stock market. It's kind of hard to find out information about them. It was started by three brothers. You've heard of Betadine, you know, with the astronauts were washed down, and they sold a laxative called Senecot. So it was a very small company bought in the 50s by these three brothers, Arthur Mortimer and Raymond Sackler. Previous to OxyContin, they had a drug, another opioid called MS-Contin, which was based on morphine, and the patent was about to expire, and they said, what can we do to sort of really ramp up a new drug, new sales? And that's when they came up with OxyContin. By that time, Arthur had passed away, but the one thing they really used from Arthur's teaching and from his years of sort of being a pioneer in medical marketing, he had made Valium and Lithium sort of, we used to call it mother's little helper. He had pioneered these medical marketing schemes, if you will, the idea of paying doctors to become paid spokesmen, so that when the first kids were dying of OxyContin overdose, and Dr. Art Van Zee, who's the doctor I write about, who's fighting back from this little rural Appalachian town called St. Charles, Virginia, when he's seeing patients that he had immunized as babies overdosing in the high school library, and he's calling them up, begging them to take it up off the market. They're, in fact, sending all these doctors and nurses and pharmacists to fancy resorts wearing OxyContin-branded beach hats at the same time. And he just couldn't get anyone's attention.
The Sackler family you mentioned there, who own Purdue Pharmaceutical, these people are great art philanthropists.
Yeah, they have wings in most of the world's most prestigious museums.
The Tate Modern has one in London, doesn't it? Is that right? Yeah. And then in the United
States. Tufts University. Right. There's something in Israel. They've spent a lot of money promoting their good name as philanthropists. And yet when you kind of look on their website, it's kind of hard to find out who the owners of the company are. They wanted their names to be on these museums, but they didn't want so much for the names to be on the OxyContin.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration that had approved this and approved these claims about OxyContin, that's always been a highly respected institution and seen a whole lot of governments around the world look to what the U.S. FDA approves and doesn't approve. How closely did the FDA look at the claims that were being made for OxyContin?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. There was a lot of anecdotal information put into the new drug application. There were some studies that Purdue had done showing that 68% of the drug could be recovered if it was smashed, as I described earlier, with the green and orange sheens. So they knew that it was potentially dangerous if people figured out how to do the end run. The guy who approved it was a physician named Curtis Wright, who approved it in 1995, actually wrote in the approval letter that care should be taken in the marketing of this drug. 2 years later, he retired and went to work for, wait for it, Purdue Pharma.
Did you see that happen a lot, a kind of a revolving door between health officials and Purdue executives?
Yes, yes. That seemed to be a big strategy, would be to somebody suing us in Maine, let's go hire the attorney general away, and that kind of thing, over and over.
You mentioned there that the drug was marketed to doctors and nurses and their various spokespeople paid by the company. How about the sales reps themselves? What kind of incentives were they given to market OxyContin in these rural communities where you live?
They were given huge incentives. One told me that you could make $100,000 in bonus a quarter, in bonus alone. And the idea was, the more you could talk a doctor into prescribing, and I'm talking about milligrams, if you could prescribe the 80 milligram more than you prescribe the 40 doctor, they would get a bigger bonus. So they were incentivized to get them to prescribe the highest milligram as much as possible. And one of the things Purdue came up with that, you know, because doctors immediately started seeing people showing signs of addiction in their practice. Van Zee would have farmers, miners come and they'd say, I lost my family, I lost my farm, I lost my home, I've lost everything. That drug is my God. And the reps would tell the doctors, oh, that's not addiction. That's something called pseudo-addiction. And guess what the cure for pseudo-addiction is? Yet more OxyContin.
How does OxyContin then connect, abuse of OxyContin, I should say, to more powerful opiates like heroin, and from there, the even more powerful drug fentanyl?
Yeah, they're all morphine-based drugs, right? And the thing about the morphine molecule, once it gets its hooks on you, people who use these drugs feel like you felt, like you were basically dope sick for 2 days, right? And you're honestly so lucky that you were able, that your wife was saying, no, we got to get you off this.
I thought she was overreacting, actually. At the time, I thought she was overreacting. And now I'll look back and go, what was I thinking?
Thank you. Once a person is physically dependent and then addicted on the drugs, at the end of your journey, you're not doing it to get high. You're doing it so you won't be dope sick.
And what do they mean by deep sea? This is cold turkey, is it, or something like
cold
that?
Cold turkey withdrawal. Almost every user I interviewed described it to a word as the worst flu times 100. So crushing, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, restless leg, and just explosive depression and anxiety.
Palpable sense of doom, that kind of thing?
Mm. Exactly what you described. Mm. And it's actually not that physically addictive, but I mean, you can get off of it, but it's something, it hijacks the dopamine receptors so that people never, they think they'll never be happy again unless they take this drug because they've had this huge surplus of dopamine on their opioid receptors. And when they stop taking it, they just, I mean, even among people who have been clean or not using opioids for a number of years, they're still at risk.
Why heroin, though? Why what makes people want to seek heroin instead of just trying to score more pills?
Right, because it's the same exact feeling. When they take heroin, it's based on morphine molecule, and heroin makes dope sickness go away just the way OxyContin and Percocet and Vicodin, et cetera, did. So when the FDA and the DEA and even Purdue reformulated its drug in 2010, the pills became harder to get. But the genie was already out in the bottle in a lot of ways. So you had all these people addicted. We now have 2.6 million Americans addicted.
2.6 million Americans addicted to
opioids. Yeah, legal and non-legal. 80% of the people who are addicted to heroin started with pills, not necessarily prescribed to them. Some, yes, but others not. And they'll do anything in order not to be dope sick.
How difficult was it in America to get the federal government to really pay attention to what was happening to a group of addicted, poor, rural Appalachians in the United States?
I'd say it was very hard. You know, Dr. Van Zee writes Purdue a letter in 2000, and I memorized this letter because it just brings the hair to the back of my neck. It was so prescient. He said, my fear is that these rural distress communities are the sentinel areas, just the way San Francisco and New York were in the early years of HIV. And he told me when I met him for the first time in 2016, he said, when I wrote that letter in 2000, I thought nobody cares when it's just a bunch of poor kids in the mountains dying. But when it hits the cities and the suburbs, people are going to notice. But I was dead wrong about that.
What did the companies say when it came to sort of accepting personal responsibility for abuse of these drugs?
They said they accepted responsibility when in 2007 they pleaded guilty in a federal court in Abingdon, Virginia, to criminally misbranding the drug. And the three top executives at the time pled guilty to misdemeanor versions of that. The company itself pled guilty to felony charges. And they said they took full responsibility. They paid $634.5 million fine. None of that money went to treatment. And actually, after that, they simply doubled down on their marketing and sales continued to rise.
Could the case be made that no one was forcing these people to take these drugs in the first place? And therefore, there's personal responsibility at issue here.
I suppose that case could be made, but, you know, the doctors were lied to. They were told the drugs weren't addictive. They told their patients they weren't addictive. And as I said, at some point, the genie's out of the bottle, and people are willing to do anything. They lose everything to this drug. I saw it over and over again.
You wrote a book about factory closures in that part of the United States, too, the declining economy and manufacturing in that area. Do you see a connection there, Beth?
Totally. It took me a while to see it. So Factory Man came out in 2014. It's about the aftermath of globalization in a former textile and furniture factory region, which had at the time had the highest unemployment rate for a dozen years, had huge disability rates, food stamps tripling. And at the end of my reporting, I was starting to hear police and prosecutors in Martinsville, Virginia say, oh, we're having just this explosion in pill crime, people breaking into people's houses to steal Xanax and OxyContin and things of that nature and resell them on the black market. It took the media a long time to put the story together, myself included.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
This is a story of terrible things that are happening in the community where you live. Was it hard to write this story?
Yeah, it was really hard. My editor said, your job is to impose hope and order on a sad and chaotic story. And I happen to be from a family that has addiction issues going back 4 generations that I know of, probably more than that.
Alcohol,
yeah, right. Yes. And there were times when I thought, oh, I can't finish this. It's so dark. I mean, I had some of the people I was following or texting me to pick them up from drug houses at night, you know, so there were these like ethical journalism questions coming up all the time. I got close to some families, maybe too close, some people would say. But it was just a lot of pain to witness over and over again. And yet the pain I felt was nothing compared to what all these families have gone through. We lost 72,000 people year before last to drug overdose, about 60,000 of them opioid related. Every one of them a tragedy, not just them, but the relatives and their friends.
Tell me about Tess Henry, a woman you befriended who became addicted to opioids. How did she become addicted?
Yeah, it's kind of the classic case of this drug spares no one. So Tess's dad is a prominent surgeon in town. Her mom is a hospital nurse, loving family, divorced when she was 10, lives in the very nicest neighborhood in the city of Roanoke with a view of the Blue Ridge Mountains from the porch. And she was doing some experimenting in college, and she became addicted to opioids. She was initially given some leftover pills, OxyContin, from a friend who had wisdom teeth surgery and only took a few, gave him the rest. And I said, what'd you think of him? Not that big a deal. I was more into drinking then. But then she went to an urgent care center, which do you have urgent care centers here, like a doc in the box, little like in strip malls that you go to on the weekend if you're injured or after hours. And she went to an urgent care center for a simple case of bronchitis. This was in 2012, and she left with 2 30-day prescriptions for opioids. One was a cough syrup with codeine, and the other was for sore throat pain.
Right, for bronchitis.
For bronchitis. Right. And at the end of the 30 days, she started feeling like you were feeling when your pills ran out. And I said, well, how did you know you were dope sick? She said, I put my symptoms into Google. And I said, holy crap, I'm probably addicted. At the time, she had dropped out of college. She was working at a very high-end restaurant. And she told me she started getting pills from a coworker of hers who was dating a drug dealer. And that if she concentrated very hard and she wore shirts with long sleeves, she could hide her addiction. She could still remember orders if she concentrated without writing them down at the restaurant. But when the pills got hard to get around 2013-14, her dealer immediately couldn't get the pills and said, but guess what I can bring in all day long? And it's a lot cheaper. And it was, of course, heroin. She starts out snorting it just as she had done with the pills. And after a while, it's so much stronger than the pills were even that she needed to shoot it up in order to keep the dope sickness at bay. And she said after 3 shots, she wrote this in her journal at the time, I was in love with that feeling.
Mm. What became of him?
So I met her shortly after she had given birth. She had been arrested for stealing at a Lowe's, a hardware store chain. And she, whereupon that night in jail, a jailer showed up with a little cup of Tylenol with codeine. And the codeine was to keep her fetus from going into withdrawal because she was 5 months pregnant and she was so skinny. She didn't notice that she had missed her periods. She was 5 months pregnant and didn't even know it. And I met her shortly after she gave birth. I mean, she had gone into treatment right up to the time that she gave birth. And when she got out of the hospital, there was no system in place to keep her treatment going. And that's the thing. That's the message of the book I hope the people take with it, that we know what works. We know the treatment works. And when she loses access to her treatment over and over in her story, she ultimately gets sent out to a rehab center in Las Vegas, Nevada, of all places, Sin City. And when she bombs out of rehab there because she isn't getting the right kind of treatment, she goes to what she knows how to do, which is to live homeless. And by this time, she's prostituting on the streets. And she's caught up in criminal gangs and prostitution gangs. And another homeless addicted person found her at the bottom of a dumpster. She had been murdered on Christmas Eve of 2017. And he was foraging for cans and he found her body. Her murder remains unsolved.
There were two weathermen who had overdosed in your hometown, two really beloved weathermen as well. How were they using heroin at the time?
They were using it at parties, and they were, what were they? It was called, they were injecting it under the skin, not in a vein. And it was kind of the step before people inject it in a vein. I forget what it was called, but they could still get away with it if they wore long sleeves and they did a good job at work.
What would putting it under the skin rather than in the vein do? Why would
they thought it was a way to, a lesser way to do it.
What, slow release?
Yeah, slow release, not as impactful.
Right.
And they thought it would help them not get addicted, but of course it caught up with them. They one of them overdosed at a party, and it made the news because I live in a community, a small community, mid-sized city of about 250,000. And the weathermen are the famous people in town, right? So it made the news, was clearly distressing for them. They've both gone on to, they've moved. They're not in those positions anymore. But that sort of put the community on notice. Like, what? These kind of handsome people with good jobs, white people, are doing drugs? And then we didn't really write about it as a newspaper for several years. I actually reported on a couple of suburban kids from a suburb called Hidden Valley, which is ironic because they were so good at hiding their addiction, when their lives were changed by heroin. One overdosed and died, and the other one, I followed his story as he was preparing to go to prison for his role in having sold the heroin that resulted in the death for his former private school classmate. And this was a three-part series on the front page of our paper, and readers sort of literally spit up their coffee and then went, what? Wealthy white people are doing heroin? And it was just a slow, long time. We knew about OxyContin in the coal fields because we had covered the Purdue story and the settlement in 07, but not until it hits the upper middle class communities do people really go, holy crap, you know, this is happening.
Is there a racial element to a lot of this in America? I mean, given that when it's happening in black communities, it's seen as a scourge of the nation and an evil. But when it happens amongst nice white weathermen, it's a tragedy then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was a tragedy when it was happening with crack.
Yeah.
Too, but you know, we were so pro mass incarceration at that time too, right? One of the interesting things about this story is African Americans were initially thought to be protected from the opioid epidemic because doctors didn't trust them because of racism to responsibly take opioid pills.
Man.
Right? And then Now they have some of the highest, especially in the cities, some of the highest overdose rates because they tend to get the heroin that's the most cut with fentanyl. And now we have this new, you know, synthetic opioid called fentanyl that people are mail ordering off the dark web from Hong Kong and pressing into pills and selling in college parking lots as Xanax when it's really fentanyl. And now we have most of the opioid deaths of those numbers I just gave a bit ago, 60,000 in 2017, are caused by fentanyl.
How much more powerful is fentanyl compared to something like heroin, for example?
Yeah, it's much more powerful.
There were many, many civil cases launched against Purdue Pharmaceutical for irresponsible marketing of OxyContin, and they all failed. Did they all fail? I mean, how far?
They did all fail.
All of them failed. What happened finally when a criminal case emerged against them?
Well, it took the federal U.S. Attorney's Office, based in Roanoke and working out of the Abingdon office, 5 years to amass enough proof, and they had it like in scores of boxes, you know, at the press conference when they announced that Purdue was pleading guilty to criminal misbranding. It took them 5 years. The families of the first overdose dead, organized. They called themselves Relatives Against Purdue Pharma. This is back in 01 and 02. An IT guy out of, his name was Ed Bish, out of Philadelphia, put together a message board, which was a precursor to websites. You might remember those. This before the internet was widely known, because people didn't know that this was happening. And so he called it oxykills.com. And people would share from all over the country the stories and like little testimonies, memorials about their children. And this group started feeding this nascent federal investigation information about the case. And then these, you know, these government lawyers went after it really hard. And that case could have been filed or investigated anywhere in the country, but it happened out of the Roanoke, Virginia office. And they were making the argument that they felt it first because of being so close to Appalachia.
Were families allowed to attend this court case.
They were. And, of course, everything had been decided before in this big plea agreement, right? Like, no jail time, $634 million. But the judge allowed the families to go on the witness stand and talk. And so Ed got to go and talk about his son, Eddie, about being called home late at night and the paramedics saying, I'm sorry, your son is dead from what? Oxycontin. He said, the first time I heard the word Oxycontin, my son was dead from it. He had no idea. A woman from Florida named Lee Nuss came, and she said when she leaves home, she leaves her son Randy's ashes, he was 18, in an urn on the mantle, and then she takes this little urn with her wherever she goes. And she testified at several of the other cases, the civil cases that didn't win. So she shows up in Abingdon at the federal case, and she whips out, as she's leaving the witness stand, she whips out this little urn, and she shakes it at the executives and said, this is your drug, and this is what it did to my son.
Did you speak to people at Purdue or the Sackler family?
I did not. I spoke to the legal counsel's son. I was trying to tell the story from the perspective of what was happening at the time. So Howard Udell, I spoke to his son. He had been a prosecutor himself and, you know, of course, kind of said, what a great guy his dad was. He never did anything illegal. What a sham this was that he had to check in with his probation officer for 3 years before going to visit him across the state lines. I mean, it was very clear. They had said in the media, you know, even before the end of that plea agreement hearing, that this drug was helping so many people and they, you know, that the government was cherry picking data. And so when you talk to these families now that were in the original Relatives Against Purdue Pharma group, I'm on an email chain with them. I hear from them every day because every day it's in the news. You know, New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts have actually named the Sacklers in their new lawsuits against them. And what they want to happen is they want everything to come out because when there's a settlement, as there was in 07, as there was recently in Oklahoma, $270 million Purdue's paying, all the documents get sealed. And they want those documents. They want the public to know the truth. And most Americans do want the public to know the truth.
It seems to me this crisis has been induced by multiple failures in a whole bunch of different areas. Failures of from regulatory bodies, failures from areas to provide decent work for people in the first place, and failures of treatment as well. In your research, what treatment works for people who find themselves addicted to opioids and want to get off it?
Right. So there's this big notion promulgated by a lot of 12-step groups that abstinence is the only answer, that you're only, quote, clean if you're abstinent.
This is like the AA approach, is it? Right.
Exactly. But every significant scientific body from the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control show data and have numerous studies showing that what's called medication-assisted treatment, or MAT for short, and that is there are three different kinds, methadone, I know you've heard of here. There's also buprenorphine and naltrexone, which is an injectable form, work 50 to 60% better than abstinence, which only works in around 8% of all cases.
These are all opioids as well, aren't they? These drugs you're speaking of here. How are they different from things like the other opioids we've been talking mm-hmm. about?
They're weaker opioids, and they're considered maintenance medicines. And they have a blocker on them, so that if you shoot heroin after, if you're taking buprenorphine, you're not going to feel, you're just going to feel, they say, patients that I've interviewed, they say, it just makes me feel normal. It reduces my cravings. It keeps me from being dope sick, and I can get, you have families now getting their loved ones back. They're taking a stable dosage of the drug. They're being monitored. They're hopefully getting really good counseling and social supports, and they start to get their kids back, their jobs back. There's a woman in one of Dr. Van Zee's patients that I've interviewed multiple times. She's now going to school to be a nurse. She's from a family of eight. Every single one of them has either been in prison or overdosed, except for her, but she was addicted herself. I mean, some of these communities in Appalachia have just been destroyed.
Do they have access to this medical-assisted treatment?
It depends. If you live in Massachusetts, which was an early Medicaid expansion state under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, you could overdose, go to the ER, and you would be hooked up with a treatment program appointment for the next day to get services. If you live in a state, we still have 14 states that haven't passed the Medicaid expansion. Largely, they were red states, Trump-supporting states, and
this is where the government, state government, has said we don't want the Affordable Care Act to operate in our
right.
state, more or less.
Right. And they have some of the worst opioid problems, and it's really hard for them to access treatment. Now, it's starting to change a bit, but and I've been doing some reporting on that, some really hopeful things I'm seeing, but it's just little pockets. And if you look at the money that the federal government's put into the crisis, about $6 billion so far, experts believe it's going to take $80 to $100 billion to totally fold in addiction medicine with our healthcare system. So it's just tinkering around the edges. I mean, sure, we're prescribing less. Sure, we're making MAT a little bit more available. But the statistics say that only about 20% of people who have this problem actually have access to the medication. One in five. That's terrible.
What about the abstinence programs? I'm run by very well-meaning people.
Very well-meaning people.
But how are they doing?
About 6 to 8% effective. So what I saw over and over, especially with Tess, who I got to know the best, her story that I talked about, the doctor's daughter, who ended up murdered on Christmas Eve. What I saw, and as I say, this is beginning to change, but I would take her to NA meetings. And she would ask, she would enjoy them. She would ask to be sponsored or to have somebody who had been in the group for a while kind of be her mentor. And when they would find out she was taking buprenorphine, the MAT, they would decline because they considered it, quote, unclean. And that felt like daggers to her. The same thing, and a lot of people, when she went to Las Vegas, we just learned recently that they did actually offer MAT at the treatment center where she was. But she thought she herself thought she wasn't clean unless she was doing abstinence only. So that there's a big stigma out there about that. And I think that's really the number one key to turning back the crisis is to making it more available so that when people overdose, they can get on the medicine. And people really getting into the weeds of MAT to understand that this is really the only way, if you look at the numbers, that people are getting better. It is a drug. It's a weak opioid, but it's a drug blocker, and you're less likely to overdose and die if you take that. If it was my kid, I would want them on MAT.
How many people who were using, like that you spoke to, genuinely wanted to kick it?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, many people I wrote about were already dead before I met them. But if you talk to Tess, for instance, and you can see it in this podcast I'm doing, you see her so badly want to get home. She was trying at the end of her life to get back to Virginia from Las Vegas because she knew it wasn't safe for her. And she knew she had looked up the methadone clinic hours. She knew when she could go and re-register. And she knew that she needed the daily affirmation of having to go to the clinic every day because they have to go at like 5:30 in the morning. And she needed that daily act of getting the drug in order to keep herself going. She had tried Suboxone before, had lost her Medicaid when she lost custody of her son, had been abusing it at one point. But if you look back at the history, when she was taking it correctly, that was when she was doing the best. And she knew that she was going to die unless she got on methadone. In fact, when they found her body, they did some research and found this abandoned minivan where she had been living with a pimp. And there was a buprenorphine prescription there, a bottle. And she had prostituted to get the drug. And when her mother and I went out to Las Vegas to find out what happened, her mother's amazingly strong. And one of the last trips we made was to a friend of Tessa's where she had had her mail sent because she's homeless and doesn't have an address. And her mother opens her mail and she sees it's a Medicaid card from Nevada. And Tess knew that that's what she needed. She knew she needed the medicine. I mean, she was homeless. She figured out how to apply for Medicaid, which isn't that easy. And that's when her mother just lost it. She was trying so hard to get home, to get with her son, to get better for her son.
Even when people want to kick the addiction and they do have access to medically assisted therapies, the kind of therapy that you say is the evidence shows that has the best approach. Even with all that, how long does it typically take to kick the addiction?
I think most people are dope sick for about 5 days. So it's not that long. It's not life-threatening, unlike alcohol, which is if you have a terrible alcohol problem, or even Xanax and those category of drugs. It's more just they, without the medication, they can't overcome the cravings to go back and use. So you see her over and over doing it for a couple of days. There's an anecdote in the podcast where she and her friend they're watching that show Intervention, and they make marijuana tea, and that's helping her get through her dope sick feelings. And she makes it another couple of days. And then before she can get to the methadone clinic or before she can prostitute and get more MAT, she's back out on the streets using again. It's like it's hijacked her brain.
One of the first users you interviewed had a story about being prescribed Suboxone, one of these therapy drugs, who told you that doctors were giving out twice as much as was necessary in order to help fund their treatment. Tell me how that process worked.
I had to have her explain that twice. I was like, "What? Are you kidding?" So there's a lot of cash only clinics, especially in rural areas, that were allowed to proliferate, and in my view, should have been regulated. That's starting to change now with Virginia finally expanded its Medicaid, and they have incentives now to accept Medicaid. But at the time, and Tess, I saw this with Tess too. Her doctor would only accept cash. So the first time she went, she had to have $500 cash up front. She had Medicaid at the time. Only accept cash because the Medicaid reimbursement wasn't big enough, et cetera, et cetera. So they're starting to change that. But what this user told me at an MAT clinic, a well-run one actually, she said, oh yeah, at the bad places, they give you twice as much as you need because they know the only way you can afford to come back next week is if you take half and sell the other half.
Wow. Wow. So, this is the workaround.
There's workarounds in every little narrative turn in this story, right?
You know, Australia has national public health like Britain does. And I think it was in Private Eye magazine in Britain that I saw this cartoon. And it was like, what if Breaking Bad had been made in the UK? And so you have Walter White going to a doctor, and the doctor says, I'm sorry to tell you, Mr. White, but you have terrible cancer. And he goes, oh, man, he's thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to go and make ice so I can sell it, crystal meth, so I can sell it to afford my treatment. And the doctor says, but that's okay because it's all funded by the national healthcare system. And he goes, oh, well, back to teaching then. That was the cartoon there. Like I say, it seems to me there's all these intersecting problems in America that have led to this crisis. Is that how you see it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the jobs went away. There was nothing done for the people who were left behind. Many of them, all they could do in order to make ends meet was to go on disability, you know, and part of that was because, you know, the welfare had been cut back. So then you have this unintentional program that's helping these desperate people. And they realize, as with in the case that we just talked about with the Suboxone, that they could get with their Medicaid card, they could get a prescription for OxyContin. They could take half and sell the half, and it became a side hustle like moonshining used to be in the old days.
My wife's currently reading a book about China's opium wars, where the British connived to have large parts of the Chinese population in the 9th century become addicted to opium. And according to her reading, when the opium importers were asked about the morality of what they were doing, they were saying things like, we're not forcing this on them. They're choosing to do this. Does that ring a few bells with you? Do you see similarities with today's situation in the United States?
Yeah. At the beginning, you know, Richard Sackler, in a recently released deposition from the Kentucky court case, you know, that the Purdue fought to release. But initially, he said they found an email that he wrote. He said, we're going to hammer on these abusers in every way possible. Always blame it on the addicted person who is misusing our drug. Never blame it on the drug itself or the fact that we lied and said it was non-addictive when it was totally addictive.
This is an amazing story. It's an astonishing work of journalism as well. It's been so great having you on the program, Beth.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Beth Macy is the author of Dope Sick, and she's in Australia as a guest of the Sydney Writers Festival. Today's conversation with Beth will be available for you soon as a podcast, and you can find it on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. And you can get it from wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.